Neither Juba nor Robin moved or looked directly at the old man until he squatted a dozen paces from them. Then slowly Robin turned her head towards him. The old man whimpered with fear. It was clear to Robin that he had been selected as an emissary because he was the least valuable member of the tribe, and Robin wondered what threats had been made to force him to come down from the hilltop. Moving very slowly and calmly, as though she were dealing with a timid wild creature, Robin held out a stick of half-cured buffalo meat. The old man stared at it, fascinated. As Juba had told her, these people probably existed almost entirely on their meagre crops, and such roots and wild fruit as they could glean in the forest. Meat was a rare treat, and such an unproductive member of the tribe would be given only a very little of what there was. The way he stared at the piece in Robin's hand made her believe that the old man had not had so much as a taste of the buffalo haunch that had been sent up the night before. He was more than half-starved. He rolled his tongue loosely around in his toothless mouth, gathering his courage, and then shuffled close enough to hold out the claws of his bony fingers, palms cupped upwards in the polite gesture of acceptance. "There you are, dearie," Robin placed the stick in his hands, and the man snatched it to his mouth, sucking noisily upon it, worrying it with his smooth gums, drooling silver strings of saliva as his mouth flooded, his eyes streaming again, this time with pleasure rather than fear. Robin laughed with delight, and the old man rapidly blinked his eyes and then cackled around the stick of meat. The sound so comical that Juba laughed also, the laughter of the two younger women rippling and tinkling without restraint. Almost immediately, the dense leaves of the millet garden stirred and rustled, as other dark, half-naked figures came slowly forward, their anxiety relieved by the sound of laughing women. The hilltop settlement consisted of not more than 100 individuals, men, women, and children, and every one of them came out to stare and laugh and clap as Robin and Juba climbed the steep, twisting path. The old silver-headed man, almost unbearably proud of his achievement, led Robin by the hand possessively, screeching out explanations to those around, pausing every now and then to perform a little shuffling dance of triumph. Mothers held up their infants to look at this marvellous being, and the children ran forward to touch Robin's legs and then squeal with their own courage, skipping away ahead of her up the path. The pathway followed the contours of the hillside, and it passed between defensive gateways and under terraced walls. Above the path, at every steep place, were piled boulders, ready to be hurled down upon an enemy. But now Robin's ascent was a triumphant progress, and she came out into the village, surrounded by a welcoming throng of singing, dancing women. The village was laid out in a circular pattern of thatched and windowless huts. The walls were of a plastered clay, with low doorways, and beside each hut was a granary of the same materials, but raised on poles to protect it from vermin. Apart from a few diminutive chickens, there were no domestic animals at all. The space between the huts and the central courtyard was swept, and the whole village had an air of order and cleanliness. The people themselves were handsome, though none of them carried any excess flesh or fat. Robin was reminded by their slim, lithe bodies that they were almost exclusively vegetarian. They had alert and intelligent faces, and the laughter and singing with which they welcomed her was easy and unaffected. "These are the people whom Zuga shot down like animals," she thought, looking around her with pleasure. They had set a low, carved stool in the shade for her, and Juba squatted beside her. As soon as Robin was seated, the old man squealed importantly, and a giggling young girl brought her a pot of the millet beer. Only when she had drunk a mouthful of the beer did the crowd fall silent and draw aside to let a commanding figure come through. On his head was a tall headdress of animal fur, similar to the one worn by the chieftain on the Elephant Road Pass. He wore a cloak of leopard skin over his shoulders, the skins so worn that they must have been very old, probably the heredity symbol of his chieftainship. He sat down on another stool, facing Robin. He was a man of middle age, with a pleasant, humorous face and a lively imagination, for he followed Robin's sign language with attention, and then acted out his own replies with facial expressions and gestures that Robin understood readily. This way he asked her from where she came, and she showed him the north, and made a circle of her hands towards the sun for each day's travel. He wanted to know who was her husband, and how many children she had. That she was both unmarried and childless was a source of amazement to the whole village. More beer was brought, and Robin felt slightly light-headed, and her cheeks turned pink and her eyes shone. Juba was contemptuous of their hosts.
"They do not even have a goat,"
she pointed out scornfully. "Perhaps your brave young men have stolen them all," Robin answered tartly, and raised her beer pot in salute to the chief. The chief clapped his hands, signalling his drummers to stoop to their instruments. The drums were hollowed tree trunks, beaten with a pair of short wooden clubs to a frantic rhythm that soon had the drummers running with rivulets of sweat and glassy-eyed with the mesmeric effects of the beat. The chieftain threw off his leopard-skin cloak and launched himself into the dance, swirling and leaping until his necklaces and bracelets jangled and rattled. On his chest he wore a pendant of ivory, snowy-white polished ivory, and it caught the firelight, for by now the sun was long set. Robin had not noticed the ornament before, for it had been covered by the cloak, but now she felt her eye drawn repeatedly to the bouncing white disc. The disc seemed too perfectly shaped, and as the chief came bounding up to her stool to perform a solo pass before her, Robin saw that it was decorated with a regular pattern around its border. The next moment her heart raced with excitement, for the decoration was writing. She was not sure in what language, but it was Latin script, that was certain. Then the chief had gone, leaping away to prance in front of his drummers, exhorting them to greater efforts. Robin had to wait until the chief exhausted himself and staggered panting back to his stool to quaff a pot of the thick grey beer, before she could lean forward and get her first close look at the ornament. She had been mistaken. It was not ivory, but porcelain, and its perfect shape and whiteness was immediately accounted for. It was an item of European manufacture, the lid of a small pot, the type in which tooth powder or potted meats are sold. The writing was English, printed in neat capitals with the words, "Patum Paperium, the Gentleman's Relish." She felt her skin go clammy with excitement. Clearly she remembered her father's rage when the pantry at King's Lynn had been bare of this delicacy. She remembered as a small girl running down the village street in the rain to the grocer to buy another pot. "It is my one weakness, my only weakness," she remembered her father's exact words while he spread the savoury paste on his toast, his anger mollified, so that he came near to making a joke of it. "Without my gentleman's relish, I doubt I would have had strength for the transverser." When Robin's mother left for Africa on that last ill-fated voyage, there had been a dozen cases of the relish in her luggage. There was only one possible way that the porcelain lid could have reached here. Robin stretched out a hand and touched it. But the chief's expression changed instantly, and he jumped back, out of reach. The singing and drumming came to an abrupt halt, and the consternation of the entire village made Robin realise that the porcelain lid was a charm of great personal magic, and that it was a disaster that another hand had touched it. He made an attempt to mollify the chief, but swiftly he covered himself with his leopard cloak and stalked away to his hut at the end of the village. The festivities were clearly ended. The rest of the villagers were subdued and crept away after the chief, leaving only the silver-haired, toothless ancient, possessive as ever, to lead Robin to the hut which had earlier been set aside for her. She lay awake most of the night on the plaited reed sleeping mat, excited at the evidence that her father had passed this way, and worried that she had ruined her relationship with the Mashona chief and would learn no more of the ornament, and through it, of her father. She did not have an early opportunity to meet the chief again and make amends for her breach of manners. The villagers kept away from her, obviously hoping she would go. But she stayed on stubbornly in the hilltop village, attended only by the faithful old man. For Robin was the most important thing that had ever happened in his long life, and he was not going to relinquish her for the chief or for anybody else. In the end, there was nothing for it but to send the chief an extravagant gift. She used the last ket of Samsam beads and one of the double-bladed axes. The chief could not resist such princely bribes, and though his attitude was cooler and more reserved than at first, he listened attentively while Robin asked her questions, acting out little charades, which the chief discussed seriously with his elders before giving his answers. The answer was southwards again, south for 5 circles of the sun, and the chief would send somebody to guide Robin. He was obviously pleased to be rid of her at last, for though her gifts were welcome, the chief was still deeply troubled by the ill fortune that her sacrilegious action must bring upon the tribe. For a guide, the chief chose the silver-headed old man, ridding himself of a useless mouth and an unwelcome visitor at one stroke. Robin had doubted that her guide's thin legs could carry him either very fast or very far. However, the little old man surprised her. He armed himself with a long throwing spear, which looked as old and frail as he did himself, and on his head he balanced a rolled sleeping mat and a clay cooking pot. These clearly constituted his total worldly possessions. He girded up his tattered kilts and set off southwards at a pace that had Robin's porters grumbling again. Robin had to restrain him. It took a little time to get the old man to understand that he was now her language tutor. As they marched, she pointed at herself and everything around them, naming them clearly in English, and then looking at him inquiringly. He returned the look with equal inquiry in his roomy old eyes. However, she persevered, repeating her own name, Namusa, as she touched her chest, and suddenly he understood. He slapped his own chest. Karanga, he squeaked. Karanga! Once again his enthusiasm for this new activity was such that she had to restrain him. Within a few days Robin had dozens of verbs and hundreds of nouns which she could begin stringing together, much to old Karanga's delight. However, it was 4 days before Robin realized that there had been an initial misunderstanding. Karanga was not the old man's name, but the name of his tribe. It was too late to rectify, because by that time everybody in the caravan was calling him Karanga, and the old man answered to it readily. It was difficult to get him to leave Robin's side. He followed her wherever she went, much to Juba's disgust and undisguised jealousy. "He smells," she told Robin virtuously. "He smells very bad." Which was true, Robin had to admit. But after a while you do not notice it so much. There was one thing, however, which could not be so readily overlooked. It appeared from under the old man's kilts whenever he squatted, which he did whenever at rest. Robin solved this by giving old Karanga a pair of Zuga's woolen underwear and taking her chances with her brother's wrath later. The underwear filled old Karanga with almost unbearable pride. He preened and strutted like a peacock as they flapped around his long, thin legs. Old Karanga led them cautiously wide of every occupied village along their route, although he assured Robin they were also of the same tribe. There seemed to be no trade nor commerce between these settlements, each perched on its fortified hilltop in suspicious and hostile isolation.